Accession number 28457, Reel 4.
And it pulled across the scarpa. And there was no Aurora, because she was at sea. So I was told to go to the depot ship. Now, the depot ship was an extraordinary Union Castle liner called the Dundas Castle. And she was a real old tub. She didn't go to sea anymore. She was anchored. And when I went down to my cabin, which they gave me, I switched on the light. And there was a wave of cockroaches running for shelter. And they just went and left the cabin sort of clean. But the place was absolutely infested with these little, with these beastly things. Anyway, I was in that for about 3 days. And then Aurora came in and I went on board.
Were you with any of your original term?
No, I wasn't. Some of them went up to Scarpa into other ships, but our paths didn't cross. I was on my own then.
What were your first impressions of the Aurora?
Well, I joined the ship, and she was she'd been on a sweep, and they said, "Son, we haven't been able to celebrate New Year. You're the youngest chap on board. You will celebrate New Year. You know what you have to do." I didn't know what I had to do. But anyway, I found somebody who did know what to do. And what you have to do is to ring in 16 bells at midnight. So I did that. First task. Because I was subterranean alone, I was part of the wardroom. I was a junior officer in the wardroom. And there were about, I suppose, 12 other officers. There was a captain who lived in his own quarters, of course. There was an executive officer, who, a chap called Sheffield. There was a gunnery officer called Michael Lefanu, who subsequently became a First Sea Lord. And there was a torpedo officer called Swan, and there were various others. I had a cabin which I shared with an engineer officer. She was a much smaller ship than the I've been used to, but she was much bigger than a destroyer. And she was a ship with which I retained, for which I retained great affection. She was a happy ship too. Very lucky. By today's standards, really short on mod cons, but somehow very happy. She didn't have stabilizers. She was wicked in a seaway. But she was light, you know, known as a light cruiser, and I was given the turret on the quarterdeck to be in charge of. And I spent a lot of my time doing what subalterns have to do, and that is to get their watchkeeping certificates. So you spend a lot of your time on the bridge, and in war there's, you have a chap called a PWO, who's the principal warfare officer. And he was the gunnery officer in my watch. And he was Michael Lefanu, so there was absolutely nothing that I didn't learn about driving a ship and getting being a watchkeeping officer.
And you said you were in the wardroom for the first time.
Yes.
What was that like?
Oh, absolutely marvellous. It was just friendly, jolly good. And it was a very happy community. And the officers ranged in, from the executive officer, who I suppose was in his 40s, just, and the others were going down, and I was the youngest, just 21, or just 20 actually, then. And
what sort of activities took place in the wardroom?
Well, we had a very busy time being at sea, doing mostly patrols or going in and out. When we came back, we were busy with divisional work. I had the quarterdeck division with the guns. I was 2-6 inch on for quarterdeck. So I had these sailors to look after. And divisional work is really sort of being like a nanny to the sailors, bringing them up, encouraging them to get promoted, sorting out their problems, and all the rest of it. But anyway, because it was a happy... Oh, and I was a cinema officer, too, so I used to run movies. But the wardroom was an oasis of sort of civilized behavior in the middle of this otherwise rather rough and ready outfit. But they were an exceptionally nice crew of officers. We didn't see much action. We sank a tanker off Iceland, which was unescorted, and we were involved in a night action briefly off the North Cape of Norway, which was one of those things when you don't know what the hell's going on. Your guns were fired.
Were you just by, was the Aura by herself?
Well, I was in the turret with the turret's crew, and they were.
No, was the ship by herself?
No, there we were a ship called Nigeria, which carried the Admiral. I think, I don't know who the Admiral was, can't remember. But there were two of us, and we did this sweep because they reckoned there were going to be some German ships to intercept. And it's called, I can't remember what the battle's called, but it is referred to somewhere. But although there was exchange of gunfire, nothing happened.
This would have been in 1914?
1941. Now, the ship had been operating off Norway, and they had quite a hard time off Norway. They hadn't been hit, but they had been in quite fierce action, mostly with aircraft. And I think this is what had knitted the officers together, because they'd all come through this.
And the purpose of your patrols was to watch out for other ships. I mean, you weren't escorting.
Yes, no, we weren't escorting.
Convoys.
We did the odd escort of a convoy in the Atlantic, but nothing anti-submarine. The other patrols we were sent on as a result of intelligence that there might be something, and one went out to see if we could find them. Towards the end of about three quarters of the way through my time in Aurora, the ship was due for refit. So we went down to the Tyne, and when it's dried up at South Shields, and I think we were there 3 weeks, if I recall correctly, and I was home on leave for a week, and the rest of the time the ship. And there were bombs then. There were no HE bombs there. There was a certain amount of incendiary bombing, which fell around the dock, but didn't involve the ship.
Can I ask you about your job in charge of a turret?
Yeah.
A gun turret. Could you describe what that involved? What sort of guns were they?
Six-inch guns. There were two of them. And well, you were in charge of the turret. So you received messages from the gunnery officer, from the captain, and you were responsible for seeing that the turret did what it was supposed to do, training itself around, and if necessary, loading and firing the guns. And you had a guns crew, of course, who were very highly trained for the purpose. But because we were only in action against targets that did not retaliate, it was a very sort of one-sided thing. But we were in action twice, and one wasn't in action every day of the week, in fact. A tremendous amount of time at sea was spent just patrolling, looking all the time. And you remember what I said about the lookouts? Well, that applied very much to a ship in which the radar was extremely limited, and you relied on the human eyeball.
After the refit?
Yes.
What happened then?
The ship went back to Scarpa, where she was based, and there was talk of her going out to the Med, and we all thought that was great. However, first of all, we went to Spitsbergen, which was different to the Med, and we were sent up to evacuate the Russians and Norwegian people that were still up there. And we first went to a place called Longyearby, which was a Norwegian settlement. And then we went round to the Russian settlement. The Norwegians, they sent a ship forward to take her. The Russians, however, we had to evacuate back to Longyearbyen, where they were going to meet a Russian ship. And I was again in charge of the boat. We had a thing called a motor cutter, which was a powered, medium-sized ship. It was open. I had to pick up some Russians from a jetty. And this gang of sort of extremely wild-looking men and women came down, dressed in the most appalling sort of clothes and looking like nothing on earth. And we started to embark them in the ship, and we couldn't have taken more than about 20, I suppose. And a chap came down with a pig. And I said, and he was clearly, he wanted to take it on board with him. And I realized that, you know, this was probably his only sort of possession, this animal, which he anyway was going to feed his family. So I said, no, he couldn't do that. And he thought I meant that he couldn't have the pig on board the boat. And so he cut the pig's throat and chucked the pig into the boat and followed it. There was nothing I could do about this, but we were, you know, the whole bloody place was bleeding. And I knew the commander would be very, very angry indeed. Anyway, we struggled back to the ship and got rid of this blessed beast. And of course, I had to clean the boat out. But I mean, that's the way these things went. But we took the Russians back to Longyearbyen when they put them ashore and they found their way back to Russia, presumably. And we went back in the ship. When we got back to Scarpa, there was another telegram for me. This one said, without giving anything away, it said, report for medical examination. And it gave an address in St. James's Street at such and such a time, which was 48 hours ahead. So they dined me out, and I was poured off the ship and took the train, the Jellicoe, back to London, and presented myself at this place in St. James's Street, which was actually in the most lovely room on the first floor of what later became a very successful wine merchant called Berry and Rudd. And in this room, which, well, bow window like this, overlooking St. James's Street, very gracious surroundings, were about six or seven other officers, some of whom I knew. And I said, what are we doing here? And they said, oh, we're going to fly, they said. And so I said, oh, I don't think that's quite what I want. And remembering how successful I've been in disengaging myself from submarines, I set about thinking quietly how I could get out of this. It's interesting that at that time, the Fleet Air Arm was still regarded as being very highly eccentric. I mean, aeroplanes were regarded by admirals as bloody menace. And the officer of the Fleet Air Arm, as I mentioned before, the one at Dartmouth, who was a term officer representing the Fleet Air Arm, was always a bit eccentric. And they were different. They were wilder. And they were less responsible, it seemed to us. And anyway, I didn't want to be associated with the Fleet Air Arm because I joined the Navy to be a sailor, see. Anyway, in the course of conversation, I began to occur to me that one of the officers that I knew, who'd been in Exmouth, two terms ahead of me at Dartmouth, was a fellow called Alan McKinnon. And I suddenly remember that his father had been Second Sea Lord. Now, the Second Sea Lord is the chap who does all the appointments and the personnel. And I realized that if he couldn't get out of it, I certainly couldn't, because I had no pull like that. So I lived with my fate and became an observer in the Fleet Air Arm.
It always amuses me as to how they pluck people out and choose them for
different... There was a very good reason for it. We got to the point where we were 1941 now, aren't we? And the war had been going on quite a long time. some carriers had been lost. The ones that hadn't, the air crews had had a right old time. And a lot of them had been lost. And there was a big, a dawning recognition that aircraft actually were essential. Taranto was just about to happen. And that was a really justification. Anybody who had any doubts about what aircraft could do only had to look at Taranto. I mean, here was this, the Italian fleet attacked at night, ship sunk. Fantastic. Never happened before. And so they realized there might be something in this. And so there was a tremendous drive to expand the fleet era. And the only way they could do this was to get people in off the streets. And so they advertised for people who wanted to fly, which of course a lot of people did, what with the RAF and all that sort of thing. And they were given a very brief medical. And they were given an aptitude test, which was pretty sort of superficial. And if they were all right, they were given sub-lieutenants, temporary commissions, sent off to learn to fly with the RAF, or if they were observers, they went to Arbroath or to Trinidad, and then to join the Fleet Aero. And they were, but they were young men of tremendous enthusiasm, exceptional courage, as all young men, I think, were at that time with the war on. But they were completely unversed in the ways of the Navy. And the ways of the Navy are pretty unique, and damn sight more unique then than they are now. So there was a feeling, their lordships in the wisdom argued that they must have some properly trained, properly brought up officers like me, told off to go into this mess in order to give some stiffening and some awareness, spread the gospel about how you should carry on as a naval officer. And so that was how I became an observer. And after that, passing my medical, I went to Arbroath, where I did my observer's course.
Can you describe the course in Arbroath and
yes.
How long was it? And
the course was about 4 months. And we flew at what was the end of the year, in bitter weather most of the time, in either swordfish, which were open, or albacores, which were not, to do observer training. And we were, I was one of two or three properly, in inverted commas, trained officers, in amongst a group of about 20 sub-lieutenants, AR and VR.
How did the training start? When did you first take
to the air? Oh, I see. Well, we went to the air pretty well at once. We were taught how to use the fundamentals of navigation, which were extremely primitive and involved a chart and a thing that you just carry around and a sort of cursor that you would draw lines with. You were told, you were given a rough thing on air navigation, but above all, a procedure called wind finding, because you had no aids, no radio aids. And it was really a question of doing this, you see, seeing what it's doing about 20 knots from that away. We'd have to go that way in order to go that way, sort of thing. But there was a procedure. You could carry out wind finding, and you had a smoke float in the aircraft. You dropped a smoke float, and you then did a very well carefully timed circuit. And by measuring angles, you could work out the direction of the wind. And we were taught how to do this. And then we were put in the back of a swordfish or whatever and sent off to do some wind finding. And then, of course, we were told to do a navigation exercise. And for 3 months, we did nothing but navigation exercises. And we took off from a place called, God, I can't remember its name, Fifeness, I think, near the golf course at Carnoustie. And we used to fly triangular courses out to the Bell Rock and back again. And at the end of it, it's all assessed. And it was possible to assess quite accurately by taking precision timings of things. Whether you've been accurate or inaccurate, or what you got wrong, how will you judge the wind, etc., etc. And eventually, you were passed out as an observer. But life was really primitive. The mess was very nice. It was an XRF mess, nice wardroom, quite good food, decent cabins, not much going on in town, one cinema, a place we discovered we could get some whiskey without rationing. And, well, that was that. And after that, well, we'll come to that in the next chapter.
I was going to ask you, actually, what was your first reaction when you saw a swordfish? Because even by those days standards...
Oh, a swordfish. Well, I had once before been up in a swordfish in Malta. In the training cruiser, we were given an opportunity to go into swordfish, and that was another reason why I didn't particularly want to go. And we got in the airplane, and it was, of course, in Malta, it was lovely. I mean, brilliant sunshine, maximum visibility, flogging off. And we did an attack, a dummy attack, with three aircraft on some MTBs. And, well, that's not something which, if you haven't done it before, is wholly calming. You do some violent manoeuvres. You dive down like this and sort of buzz off. And, so I wasn't wholly unfamiliar. But on the other hand, a string bag, a swordfish in our breath in midwinter is another story. It's bloody cold. And so you had a flying suit, you had a helmet, you had woolly boots on, and you were damn cold, and you were trying to do all this with first and famous, you know. But the fact was that we all managed it. And what's more, and this is by far the most interesting, it actually worked. I mean, you could go in a carrier, as later I did, quite a bit of, and you could leave the carrier with nothing but a beacon to your home, if you used it, which you weren't supposed to, in case, because of radio sound. And you would come back to the carrier after flying for an hour and a half over featureless seas. And it was all done by the old estimation of the wind and that sort of thing. And it worked.